The Guardian.
This podcast is part of The Guardian Small Business Network's Adventures in Business series, supported by Hiscox Insurance. Find out more about getting the right cover for your business at hiscox.co.uk/businessinsurance. Running a small business is no easy task. You need an idea, a great idea. Then you need to make it happen. There are cash flow woes, investment concerns, marketing and PR hoops to jump through, and decisions to be made around growth. Over the past 2 months, this podcast has followed 8 business leaders and entrepreneurs through their small business adventures. We've heard about the devastating lows, the incredible highs, and have been inspired by their resolution to keep fighting adversity. We'd really recommend going back and listening to those to give you a bit of context before enjoying this episode. In this episode, we have an interview and Q&A with the last 4 of our entrepreneurs, Isabella, Emily, and Rich. And it began with a keynote speech from F.A. Chacarel, founder of Mubi, the home of international and art house film.
This journey has nothing but extraordinary and very, very difficult. I feel like, you know, it's been 10 years since I started Mubi. I feel like the first, you know, 6-7 years, I my head was underwater, and finally I'm having fun. So you start a company, you're raising money from friends and family usually, because you have a 2-page business plan that is not even coherent. You don't know the industry, you have no idea what you're doing, so it's your friends and family that give you the money. How you need to come up with a certain valuation in order to issue them shares, right? That is, so basically what your company is worth today with me and a business plan, and you raise the money, so you in order to create those shares, you need to assume a certain value for your company. And so I went to a very smart lawyer who's experienced with this stuff in Silicon Valley. He said, you know, the rule of thumb in Silicon Valley is simple. You know, for every engineer you have, you add 700,000. And for every MBA you have, you take 300,000 out, right? So at the time, we had 3 engineers and an MBA. So it was like 1.8 million valuation, which is true story. That's how we raise money. How do you even value a company with me and just, you know, 3 engineers and a 2-page business plan, right? And we set out to do what we now have, which is, you know, it was grand, the vision, and it still is the same vision, which is really amazing, 10 years on, to build, you know, the most important destination to watch movies. But I want to take you back to 2007 and what happened. So we launched, 2007 we started the company. 2 years took me and the team to get some films and build a platform to a stage where we could launch it. And very early on, we got the attention of, at the time, our model was not what we have today. At the time, our model was, you know, just independent films and all-you-can-eat model like Netflix. So we had about, 400-500 films on our platform. And it cost as much as Netflix, but it's just independent, really good quality content. And it just was not enough. People were saying, well, you know, why do I pay the same to you as Netflix, where I could go to Netflix and not necessarily have some of these titles, but some other titles, plus, you know, all the big blockbuster stuff and the TV stuff as well. And they were right. We realized this is the moment when you realize that, you know, almost 4 years, maybe almost, you know, almost 5 years into what you're doing, you don't have a business. Not a good day. We were like, it was about 14, 15 of us at the time, and I needed to let immediately that day 5-6 people go. You know, letting people go when they are not performing is easy. I can do that before breakfast. Letting good people go who are committed because you're downsizing, that's really tough. Right? That's when, you know, that's really emotional. Because we are a small team and we are in this together. But I had to do it in order for at least keeping some people on the payroll for a longer period of time. And I cut my salary to zero, obviously. And the rest of the team, I asked for a voluntary pay cut of 30 to 50%, right? And they all did. They all did. And during this time, we came up with the model of one film a day. Because we said, okay, what is our key differentiation? What are we really good at here? We were really good at curating and programming. And we can't get all the films, so why don't you just focus on a smaller set of films that refresh on a regular basis? And the idea came one day, okay, well, just one film a day. That stays for 30 days, so there is always also 30 films you can watch. So if you're not in the mood for a romantic comedy that day, you can watch a classic film. And that created the company. You know, a handpicked selection of the best films for $5.99 a month. We saw it immediately. We launched in Turkey first because we're scary. You don't know if it was going to work. So, Turkey, anything I do there sort of works. So... it worked immediately. The conversion from the most important number in my life is registered users to subscribers conversion, right? You know, that's when you give me your credit card. That number was less than 1% in our previous model, 0.8%. With this model, it was immediately more than 5. That's not an increment, that's a step change. You know, more than 5 out of 100 people who come to our platform give us their credit card within 7 days. That there is no metric like that. You know, you can really scale that. And we grew like within a month 22%. You know, you usually grew like 2 or 3% a month. And retention went down really quite significantly as well. So we, after almost 6 years, we created a company. And that's what the subscribers look like right now. All right, exponential R-square is 0.8, like almost exponential growth right now. 2 years after almost running out of business, I raised $14 million. That was already a couple of years ago. Now we are raising a lot more. But when I did that, imagine the core team. I mean, I paid them whatever salary that I cut times two back. And now they would like die for Mubi. I mean, it's just an incredible core team. But the number one rule of business is to stay in business, okay? You do whatever you need to do, you stay in business. Thank you.
Our panelists for the evening were Isabella Lane, Managing Director of Smarter Applications, Emily Forbes, Founder of Scenit, Rich Pleath, Founder of SUP, and our chair, Guardian Business Journalist Emma Shepherd, began the discussion by asking Isabella what effect the Brexit vote had on her business as it tried to expand outside the UK.
From a practical point, we thought that we knew what was going to happen, which was a lot of people's error. We thought that it would be a no vote to leaving and that everything would carry on as it was. We woke up in the morning and before we'd even got to our desks, we'd had an email to say that our investor was pulling out. They were about to buy a French bank, and they'd just been told that nobody do anything until we know what's going to happen, which I can appreciate from their point of view. Obviously, for us, it was very disappointing. Had I had the wherewithal at the time and the experience, I think I wouldn't have put all my eggs in one basket. And I'm quite careful not to... nowadays allow one person to have the fate of our company and everything we've worked so hard for in their hands. And it's you can't, again, I say that and then I was like, Trump, I did not see that coming again. So and that's had a knock-on effect for us with currency fluctuations, especially when you're in a hardware product. You're dealing with everybody wants margin points, from distributors to retailers and everyone in between. So for us, that was another sort of adjustment that we had to make. But it did really teach me not to leave the fate of your company in someone else's hands. It's yours and it's down to you. And Yeah.
So what are your plans now with America? You're still planning on exporting
yes.
there and exploring that market?
Yes, carefully. Okay. I think, as I said to you before, it's you get like the Beatles in One Direction, you get one shot at America. And if you, I think instead of, you have these fantasies, especially as a business owner, where you think you imagine yourself strolling into America and everybody falling in love with your brand and your products and it being an instant success and it being a big sellout. And especially in what we do, we love it when people order large quantities. We get really excited by that. So when sort of big companies come and say, oh yeah, we'll order X amount of fridge cams, that's a very exciting proposition. We've learned along the way that we need to do what's comfortable for us. We're bootstrapped. And so it's down to us to make sure that this works, and we're sort of trying to scale back our egos and just do what's right for the business, I think. So we'll be going in, but just slightly more carefully.
That's great. And Emily, your business obviously had quite a lot of international reach. Have these sorts of political upsets had much of an impact on you?
No, actually, ours has been fine. I've been doing trips frequently to the US, so I can get some tips from you because I'm still in the like new phase. But it's I think it's fine other than a few supplier bills going up. Mm. But there was also a competition that we won recently and the conversion then benefited us, so then we kind of balanced out. But I think the kind of international growth for us has been good. It's just then the battle more from a product side of how we make sure that we are in all the languages that we need to be in. Mm. So that's really the challenge that we're up against and how we make sure that we are servicing our clients, because we went through a stage where we did get amazing inbound and we won clients in the US. And then I had to make sure, because you had that one shot, they were being looked after. Mm. And so then I now have actually pulled back from new business and I only want to focus on the clients that we've won there, look after them, make sure that gets going before taking a step to new. But it's difficult because with the US, the whole team are then like, I want to go, I'm on the plane, oh my God, this is so cool, it's going to be great, got an outfit. So you have to kind of, like, including myself, you know, we all have to, like, rein back and kind of reset.
Yeah, that's great. Rich, you've now, you're about to launch, or you've just launched your Curious app.
About to,
very exciting. I wonder, having perhaps experienced your failure with SUP, has it made you a different entrepreneur? Do you approach business differently now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have the same experience with kind of co-founder issues as well. So I'm like a sole founder now, which is really scary at the same time, but also very exciting. But I think you learn so much from failure. Mm. And it's such a negative word that people don't like to say it. And it's if like you go out and you tell your friends or you tell strangers that you failed at something, they immediately put that into a very negative context. Whereas actually we learned so, so much from it. And it is still not, you know, it's not great that we failed. Ultimately, we knew the business was either we're going to make us millionaires or we're going to fail. And we unfortunately did fail at it. But we learned so, so much. And I go around now and I'm talking to a lot of university students, doing entrepreneur classes, and just teaching people about what it means when you're starting a business and the realistic, like, you know, consequences you actually have to go through. And the prospect, I think it's like 96% of businesses fail in their first year anyway, so there's this odds that's really stacked against you anyway in this position. But I still think that failure is such a negative word, whereas you just learn so, so much.
Do you know, there was I just realized that I really early on, the first time I went to go and raise money, we didn't get backing because I hadn't had a big enough failure at that point.
Oh wow.
The investor was like, you haven't learned enough. Yeah.
Wow.
Come back once you've screwed up. I'll go on the next one. But it is interesting, and I think I really respected that. And actually, that made me completely rethink about everything you've just said. The amount that you learn every time is just huge.
That's great. And Isabella, I guess when there are dark days, and there always will be, what's helped you push on through and just keep going?
The team. I think having a dedicated team. When it was just Christian and I, it was easy to go, oh, not today, or let's give ourselves a breather. I think when I watch my team come in day after day and protect us and fight with us and promote with us and get excited with us, that really drives me. And I think I can speak for Christian as well and say that for him. And we're really excited about the space we're in. Mm. I know for a lot of people, when you hear Connected Kettle, you do laugh. My family did, so there's no shame in it. And I understand that. But for us, the excitement around the connected home and what that's going to mean for the future and the savings and the benefits, we get really sadly excited. So yeah, it's that as well.
That's great. And Rich, for you, what do you think has helped you push on through those dark moments?
I think, you know, lots of my friends who were also like early investors and they really supported us, they, you know, I had to call all of our investors and tell them, unfortunately, they didn't make it work. And with SEIS and EIS in the UK, actually, it's not a huge issue because they do get a lot of the money back. But just the support that was there. And you are, like, you're hugely embarrassed. You know, you've got to tell your parents and stuff that you're not going to be doing this anymore or whatever it is. And there's still the aspect that failure is negative. But it's really that my friends were all there to support me. And also, like, fellow entrepreneurs, you know, you can... I'm part of a lot of entrepreneur networks. And... Mm. So many people have had a failure or they've had like a massive setback. And so you can go talk to people like Emily, we talk, and you can just have a very honest conversation about it that you couldn't maybe have with a friend because they wouldn't understand it so much, but you can have it with a fellow entrepreneur.
And Emily, any advice you'd give to an entrepreneur that might be struggling?
I think just have faith and trust your gut. I know that sounds kind of ridiculous, but any moments that I have freaked out, my gut has always been right. And anytime I go against it, it's like, fuck, whoops, I'm sorry, sure I shouldn't say that. I swear on stage. But I think that's a really, really important thing, because also if you do fail and you've trusted your gut, you learn from your lesson, you feel stronger for it. If you take somebody else's advice and go against your gut, you blame, and then you don't learn. Mm. So I think that's kind of my biggest thing, just kind of own the mistakes and then you move on from them.
Mm. That's great. Fantastic. I think now is probably a good time to open to the floor. Does anyone have any questions or comments for our panel?
I'm Marika. I just launched an app, and I'm just going through the focus groups. So it's for the question for Rich. What, instead of focus groups, just put it out there and see what people do?
Yeah, so I think a big, like, you should definitely have focus groups, because they might be like, no, this is like useful things you need to change. And in some of them, we did pick up interesting points, but the overall general feeling was that it was amazing and people wanted to use it. And when we put it out there, they didn't. But I think getting it out there and testing it in the wild is the biggest, like, and best thing you can do. Because if people are testing it, using it, you can see all the stats. If you've got a like analytics set up inside the app, you'll be able to see what is actually happening and what's like happening. But we can chat afterwards and go into more detail in it.
There's a book called The Mum's Test. The Mum Test. I don't know if you've read it. It's how you ask people questions without, like, you're talking to your mum, and they go, that's a lovely idea. So it's how, it's a really easy book to read, and
mom
it
test.
Just, the mum's test. Okay. It just helps to how to phrase a question.
Because your friends, like, they always want to support you, and they want to be like, yeah, you're going to, like, this is amazing, it's amazing. Yeah. And so asking your friends can sometimes be the worst idea, but asking, like, a fellow entrepreneur, or asking, like, you know, doing a focus group and seeing if you can actually get truthful answers out of it, or putting it out there in the wild. If people start using it and they start telling their friends about it, it organically grows. Whereas if you're forcing it, it's not organically growing, and it's not probably not going to work.
Okay. Isabella, I'm wondering whether you and Christian did any focus groups when you were developing the kettle.
Can't say that we did, thinking we should have now. I think we did the harshest test, which was that our first article was the product in the Daily Mail. And if anyone's ever read the Daily Mail before, we were very proud of ourselves. We'd launched a world's first product. It was in the newspaper, and then you read the comments section.
Don't do that.
It was painful, but it really zeroed in our attention on what people were wanting. They thought that we were signifying the end of the world, which was we took with a pinch of salt. But the rest of it, there was some good stuff in there, and so that was our kind of focus group.
Fantastic.
Put me off.
Thank you for that question. Any other questions?
Hi. Thank you for being on the panel and giving us your insights. There's really a question for both Emily and Isabella regarding going to the States. How are you going about doing that? Are you using any government resource like DIT, or are you doing trade shows there to launch? And the second part of that is, are you connecting with an importer and a distributor to bring your products?
Very, do you want to go?
Yeah, go for it.
So in terms of support, we haven't had any, not for want of trying. We did reach out to the DIT and various other things, but nothing that was of massive use to us as a company. We do CES every year, which is hugely expensive, but has been really worth it for us. It's a good place for us to launch products. It's a good place for us to meet with distributors, retailers. CES, Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Everyone goes, oh, Las Vegas. It's 7 days of pure hell, but it's very... it's a great place to be if you're like we are selling a tech product. In terms of how we've gone about it, we tend to go... it works for us. We've always gone and got interest from retailers, sold them the concept and the idea and the excitement around the product, and then asked for forecasts and gone then with those forecasts to distributors and said who fits with us and who can help us over there. So then, and I don't know, but if you're already at this point in America, but they sell differently, so you have to have an agent with you. So that's another layer of profit just...
And then importer?
We're managing that ourselves,
so
essentially.
You've set up a company over there?
We're selling FOB to start, and then when we're brave enough, we'll be getting American bank accounts.
What's FOB?
Oh, sorry, free on board. So it's just a way of selling at the port rather than having to deal with a very complicated business of shipping in taxes, having bank accounts, all of that kind of stuff in different areas. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And that's something we've had to do through trial and error and through meeting people and talking to different people.
Thank you.
And Emily?
So for us, we work with large businesses and large enterprises, and a lot of the men who we're working with here have offices there. So our first step, just to see how it works, the pickup, the conversations we need to have, is just talking to our clients here and asking for an introduction to the US teams. So it's sort of an easier first step. And then I've just been on a plane recently going back and forth, meeting with those teams, talking to them. So not focusing on new business, just that step, how the teams work differently, what sort of account managers they would need, and doing the research that way before setting up a sort of whole entity. But as we're now starting to see the pickup and scale happen there, we're going to look to set up an entity and hire people on the ground. But that will be a whole nother challenge, finding people.
Yes.
Yeah, do that tomorrow.
I think when you're looking to raise cash, either through debt or equity, are they investors always looking to be on the board? And how hands-on are they in terms of helping you grow, etc.?
We're all trying the Rich trick
now.
Yeah,
go on, Rich.
Well, so no is the answer. So lots of people don't want to be on the board, and they literally want to give you the money and have their hands free. And other investors are super engaged, and they want to be on the board. Mm. So it's entirely dependent on the person rather than anything else. And some VCs, for example, if they're investing, they insist that they have someone, and others are just want to be totally hands off. So it's entirely dependent.
So the board that we've got, that it's been amazing. Again, as a sole founder, again, that's something else you can do, have an amazing kind of non-exec or board support around you. Someone gave me some kind of good advice as well, is that the same way that you've got early employees on options, you can do the same with the board and have a time limit period, so 2 years. And then at the end of that, if you want them to continue, then that's great. And if not, it's not an awkward conversation of letting them go. It's just it came up to the end of the 2 years. That's just what someone shared with me the other day, and I thought that was quite a good tip.
Great. And Isabella, I don't know, I remember reading that you had quite a generous offer, a tempting offer early on into your journey, but you and Christian were happy that you didn't accept it in the end.
Yeah, and that's been our problem since. Our first offer of investment was X amount for X amount, and we went, no, we can get past that. And then when we get past that, imagine what we'll have then. And we're now 2.5 years later on our own, still saying, if we can just get that little bit further, our shares will be worth so much more and our proposition will be worth so much more. So we've done it a different way. It's probably been... a tad more stressful, I suppose, bootstrapping. You've probably had experience with both now, haven't you? So, yeah, I'd assume. I've fantasised that with investment, you just get to lie around all day and tell people, no.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's brilliant.
That's the dream. That's the dream. So yeah, we've turned down tempting offers because we felt like we could go the extra. We just got one little bit further to go and we could be worth X amount. So we're doing it slightly differently. But we have, yeah, pretty empty board if anyone's interested.
I think that's a very... every time we go for a funding run, I'm like, no, let's get one more month, one more month. And it's such a difficult thing
really
to do.
It's really hard. And you can end up really, if you're not really careful, hard. Stifling your opportunity because you don't have the funds to get out there and reach your potential. And it is... a very sort of personal decision to your business about when you raise and how much you raise and who you raise with. It's down to what you think is best for your business at the time.
And the most important thing with a board is just that they align with the vision. It's the same thing with the team. It's the same thing with everything. Aligning with the vision, what you want to do, where do you want to take the company? Because if you do have somebody on the board and it's just a little bit different, but you're excited to get them on the board and you want their cash, it's just going to really cause massive problems later.
Great. I think we have time for one more question. So we'll take it from this gentleman at the front.
Thanks. My name is Richard. I had a... For Rich, actually, I wanted to ask you, with SUP, do you think... Two things, actually. Do you think with more money, you could have done things better or changed things, or we would have helped accelerate maybe to get to a tipping point where you could go potentially viral? Did you need that, or would money make no difference to make it viral? And at the same time, do you kind of think that you evolve as an app, when you some apps started something and then ended up as something else? Did you kind of feel that the vision of SUP was over? You couldn't even tweak it to make it something more than it could have been. With your co-founders and your team.
So I think, in regards to the kind of the first question, I think that we were looking at like what we could do, and our competitors got massively funded. Like one of them called Zenly got 23 million, and all they were doing was buying users. We didn't buy any of our users. We were purely organic. And so if we had tons more money, we could have bought users and done Facebook ads and Instagram ads and everything else. But we were trying to become a big social network where you don't buy users, it's all organic, and you have this viral coefficient. So yes, but also we didn't want to go down that route of just raising, another 10 million and just buying users, and every user would be cost and they would just go through the funnel and there would be no retention. So I think that's a problem. And your second question, I've totally forgotten. So if I had got on with my co-founders, I think we could have evolved, but by that point there was quite a lot of bad blood between it and it really wasn't happening. But I think there is a lot that you can evolve from there.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Could we please give our panel a round of applause?
Thanks to all who attended and participated in the Guardian's Confessions of a Startup event. I've been Coco Khan, and the producer was Rowan Slaney. We hope you've enjoyed this series of the Small Business Podcast. Please share, subscribe, and review on any of your favourite podcatchers, and join the discussion on Facebook and Twitter. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.